Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today, we're lucky to be here with Jovita Benloska, a mother who dealt with severe alcoholism while her child was just an infant. In her memoir, Drunk Mom, she recounts the harrowing tale of her addiction, which found her caring more for her next swig of booze than for her child. In her memoir, Drunk Mom, she recounts the tale of her addiction, which actually found her caring more for the next swig of booze than for her child, something that she shockingly admits in the book. Her alcoholism got so bad, she was blacking out while watching her infant and calculating the vodka shots so it wouldn't get inside her breast milk. What do we say to someone whose helpless addiction has them ruining what should be the most sacred and protective bond of all, a mother and her child? Is she deserving of shame, empathy, or both? Can someone truly recover from one of the most difficult addictions of all? The answer is absolutely and completely. I've been treating alcoholism for 37 years using a combination of rational cognitive coaching and neuroplasticity, which is medical hypnosis, and I can tell you it is 100% curable. From AA to rehab, Jovita has swung between rescue and relapse for years, and we'll learn about what turned her life around and where it is right now. Jovita, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jovita, alcoholism, there are different types of alcoholism. I've been treating it with hypnosis for 37 years. There's the non-drinker, there's the social drinker who drinks only in social companies. There's the problem drinker that's not addicted. They just drink too much. Sometimes they're just bored or whatever the case might be. There's the linear alcoholic. It's the person who could have a drink or two and then stop. And then there's the acute alcoholic, the person who alcohol dominates their life. They cannot stop. They go on binges. They put the alcohol above everything else. Where would you place yourself?
That's a very good question. Right now, I'm sober. I don't drink at all. So I don't know what I would place myself right now.
Where would you place yourself during the, I'm assuming that during the worst time of your life, you were that acute alcoholic?
Sure. And I mostly just use the definition of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, it's just when your life has become unmanageable. That's usually when you end up going to a meeting, and if you come to that conclusion, you could probably identify yourself as an alcoholic. So that's what I would go with. But I know I have encountered many different types of alcoholics in the rooms of AA too. And I certainly am no expert. But for myself, according to your definition, I would be an acute.
Yeah, I would definitely agree. Let me ask you a question. What was your inspiration for writing the book?
I don't know about inspiration. I am a writer primarily. So I write all the time. I'm a journalist by profession. I write fiction right now. I report on things, and even reporting on myself and my own experience. That's just what I did. So there was no, and I don't want to disappoint readers and listeners, but there was no inspiration as to I wanted to inspire people to get sober. I simply just told my story.
Jovita, that's kind of the most refreshing thing I heard all week.
Okay.
there's a genuineness about you that just comes through. I actually appreciate it. Question. Mm-hmm. Was there alcoholism in your family? I mean, tell me a little bit about how you grew up.
Sure. Not at all, which is, that's kind of the baffling part, because I have been told over and over by medical professionals, by people, the rooms of AA, by all kinds of people, that there's a strong genetic component. But not in my case. My parents didn't drink at all. if anything, they were social drinkers, usually, you know, on New Year's Eve. And grandparents, no alcohol there. So maybe, you know, some distant family members that I'm not aware of. Certainly, I think in any family, there's some mysterious deaths that are attributed to other health issues and could possibly alcoholism. I can't really comment on that. But no, I mean, my childhood was certainly troubled in other ways, but no alcoholism at all.
Which is an interesting point that I was going to bring up. For the most part, for alcoholism, one is normally trying to run away from themselves, run away from their pain, run away from their memories, or just stop the pain. Now, your picture was attached to my notes, and you're obviously quite intelligent, quite beautiful. What were you running away from?
I don't know. My brain, maybe, because it won't stop. I don't know. No.
Let's go back. I like that. Your brain, it won't stop. So it meant that you kept on thinking and thinking and thinking. So the alcohol, numbed you out.
I don't know. I think there's a tendency to try to find sort of reason for anything, including alcoholism and addiction. I come from the sort of belief that sometimes there is no reason, or there are so many reasons that, you know, that it's hard to really pinpoint. And I certainly, you know, I had a lot of different trauma, small and big, in my life that you could say, oh, this is what I was running away from. But it's very hard for me to, at this point in my life, to figure out what is my belief in it and what has been suggested. So, again, I don't really know. I mean, I remember going to therapy when I was in my early 20s and someone saying, oh, it's because you moved from, Poland. You immigrated in your teens, and it's a very crucial period when you develop and you have a post-traumatic stress disorder, and you drink to numb that particular pain. Possibly, ever since that point, I have used that explanation to myself, and even I think in the book I talk about it a little bit, but I can't tell you with 100% certainty, you know, what I was running away from. I don't know. I mean, sometimes, you know, even now in sobriety, I get envious of people not drinking so much, but having like that, you know, end of the day glass of wine and just kind of unwinding, because that's so ingrained in, you know, I think Western society to do that kind of thing. Like, you know, had a hard day, it's Friday, you know, take a load off, have a glass of wine. So they're all running away from something, right? I mean, they're...
Well, you know, because what happens is that to some extent, you know, myself included, you know, I'll have a glass of wine with dinner at the end of my day, which is midnight. Mm-hmm. It's more of a reward. It's more of a, you know, let me chill out, you know, maybe read, you know, a book, or maybe write something, or I don't have to sleep a lot. So it's more of a reward. It's not running away. It's like having a good meal at the end of the day. Like, I worked hard, I deserve this.
Yeah.
So let me ask the question. Have you been able to replace the alcohol with something that is rewarding and that does give you a sense of stress reduction?
So to some extent, and I just wanted to go back to your, I think reward is another, in my case, in case of my relapse, it was more of a reward. I would say that's what inspired my relapse, if you can use that word, because I certainly was rewarding myself for, you know, going through difficult birth and taking care of a child. So that's how I spiraled out of control, because I was really into, you know, being nice to myself. And in my case, because I react to alcohol differently.
Now,
didn't really work out.
Let me ask this question, because, and again, mm-hmm. It seems from the book that you didn't take care of the child, and that the child suffered greatly, you know, due to your active alcoholism. Was there an awareness of your child's pain, and is there any guilt that you have associated with it now?
I have never actually defended this, so I will right now. This is the first one for me. I did not take care of my child. I was, you know, if you read the book, I talk about how I actually schedule my drinking, which is, I know, ridiculous, and I feel ridiculous defending myself here.
No, you're not,
you know,
defending. We're just discussing, and I, like I always say, right. I could be wrong.
Well, I mean, that's all I did. I took care of my child, you know, from the morning till 9 p.m. That was my reward time. I drank after I would put him to bed. Unfortunately, what happens with alcoholics is that, you know, you can only control it for so long. It starts to control you after a while. So that's what happened in my case. But I was, I can't even, you know, stress how that was part of my drinking, was this kind of full-time job of being a mom and full-time job of being an alcoholic. And the two don't really go together at all. But I have received numbers of, you know, of emails from women in very similar situations who have more than one child, who have tried to, you know, juggle both the addiction and taking care of their families. And it is possible. So I refuse to accept.
I think the only reason I said that is my producer. I read parts of your book. My producer tends to read all of it and make highlights for me. And one of the things he highlighted was a statement that when your boyfriend went away for a weekend, you passed out, and your baby was left in a pile of his own urine and milk. So
that's
why I said neglect.
Yeah, and that's certainly the reason why I described that particular event, is because that was kind of a first marker in my spiral down. And that happened. Both my sister and my boyfriend were around. They were very crucial to my son having a relatively unfortunate year in the first year, despite my alcoholism, because he was, you know, he had two adults full time and one, you know, one unconscious half of the time. But he also had, you know, a third adult, which is my sister. I don't think, because you mentioned, you know, whether there was whether he suffered. I don't know. I mean, I don't think he suffered neglect. I certainly think that there was a lot of stress around him because of my drinking. Who knows what the consequences will be, if there will be any consequences. But
how old is the child now?
He's 5 and a half.
And what's your relationship like with him now?
Oh, he's amazing. I just wanted to go back just to one thing, because
sure.
I think it's important. I talked to a very accomplished addictions expert. His name is Dr. Gabor Mate. He works with some, you know, difficult cases in Vancouver here in Canada. A lot of, you know, so-called junkies and people who live on the street. He's very well-versed in addiction. And I did ask him about, you know, possible consequences. His statement is that, you know, as long as there is one sort of full-time, conscious, loving parent around a child, you know, in a troubling environment, then chances are that child will be just fine. That in my case, that parent would be his father. So there certainly was, I was very lucky that there certainly was another adult who, you know, kind of counterbalanced my failures as a mother. So, and then to answer your other question, how my son is now, I don't know. I'm his mom, so I'm biased, but I think he's the most incredible little boy on the planet.
You know what? I tend to believe you, because the way in which you tend to just put it out there in a very, very honest way. And I do think, honestly, I do think a child could be born to two perfectly healthy, intellectual, successful parents and go right down the gutter, and another child could be born in a very troubled environment and do amazing. So
well,
I think a lot of it is in the person themselves, where they're going to go in life, as opposed to just the way they were raised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and certainly, you know, it's funny. I recently had a conversation with someone about whether my son is too spoiled. but not in a way that he's like demanding spoils, just that, you know, do we pay too much attention to him, which is ridiculous when you think of kids. And, you know, there's no such thing as paying too much attention to them. But he certainly has this, you know, incredible support and love around him. He's the only child in the entire family. There are no cousins and no, you know.
Oh, my goodness.
No, yeah.
Christmas must be a blast in your house.
He's the center of the universe. So I don't think he suffers from a lot of neglect. But he's also very affectionate and very sensitive. He's and he taught me how to play chess last weekend, so I think he's doing okay.
I think he's doing better than you. No, he's doing great.
Oh, and definitely.
At one point in your book, you made a statement, and it fascinated me because the statement was that at one point, alcoholism was more important than anything else, including mm-hmm. your child. Mm-hmm. What did you mm-hmm. mean by that, and how do you feel about alcohol?
Well, I think, you know, it's such a cunning and you know, impossible to understand, I think, condition. Addiction is that you really do things sort of against, like, your basic human instincts. So one of those instincts would be, you know, certainly motherhood. Another would be preservation of self, because you constantly put yourself in a situation that are, you know, absolutely dangerous to you and to your loved ones, whether it's through neglect or doing, you know, crazy things that younger people, I think, tend to do, you know, climbing fences and jumping off buildings and things like that, where they injure themselves terribly under the influence of alcohol. So it's certainly, it just, I think the effect it has on people is just, you know, it's kind of like a suicide in disguise, I think, in a way, for some. And so I don't know. I think it's a great social tool as well, because it, you know, it helps people lower their inhibitions and it makes them more social. I consider myself an introvert, so it certainly
helps. I could tell by the way in which you communicate that there's a shyness in you.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I mean, certainly, you know, it was one of those things that, that helped me in social situations. And I used it, I think, as a lot of young people do in their 20s, to just be more outgoing and to keep up with people who are partying around me. And you know, some people graduate from that to adulthood, and other people, you know, stay behind and keep on partying, and then it becomes a little desperate and sad. So I think that's where I was going. I miss it in a way that I idealize it and I romanticize it. And I, you know, like I was mentioning earlier, feeling envious of the, you know, glass of wine on Friday type of thing. But, you know, whenever I have that thought, I just think, well, let's look at the evidence. Let's see if, you know, if I talk to myself, let's see if you've ever had an experience where, you know, it could be just a glass of wine and gently going to bed and, like, you know, watching a movie or something. I mean, I had certainly nights like that, but it was never relaxed. Like, it was always, you know, why don't we make this a little better? Because I think that's one of the tendency of addicts, is that, you know, they're not just satisfied with feeling good, and I talk about it in a book. They want to feel really, really, really good, and then they want to feel ecstatic, and then they want to feel, you know, ecstatic and euphoric. Usually at this point you go into blackout, so you no longer feel anything. But there's no, it's I don't know. I find addiction is just this endless mouth. That,
yeah, it's quite complicated. I mean, my specialty is a combination of executive life coaching, a lot of behavioral therapy, life coaching, and neuroplasticity, which is medical hypnosis. So when mm-hmm. I work with addicts, I'm usually rewiring the neurological system so that they actually don't ever want to drink. They actually hate mm-hmm. the concept. So they're not mm-hmm. fighting it on a daily basis. It's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different model. Mm-hmm. You know, because the romanticizing and the missing it at one point could lead you being vulnerable in the wrong, you know, in a bad situation. But I think most addicts do feel like it is, of course, one day at a time. You've gone. Are you still going to the program, Trust the Program?
Yeah, I do. I go mostly to just, you know, just to remind myself where, you know, proverbially come from, and also because you do have fresh, you know, fresh addicts in there who do remind you through their stories or because, you know, they need help. And it's a good community to have. So I go for those reasons. I've been going long enough that I don't feel I need to go all the time to you know, to stay sober. I keep mentioning this Friday night and this envy of drinking. I actually don't have it that often. I think it was related to question that you asked. I don't think about it almost at all. I mean, I think about it because I talk about it all the time, so I have to remember it. But it's not like I don't have cravings. I don't, you know, I can kind of not notice it at all. I do find it interesting what you said, and I haven't thought of it, that there's possibility of not missing it at all, not romanticizing it. It's very interesting to me.
My comments on AA is that for some people it works, and for others it makes it worse. You know, I don't see AA as the solution for everyone. I see some people identify, and other people, they so don't identify that it makes them go out and drink because they can't really identify with the other people. You seem to have been able to work a good balance. Tell me a little bit about your husband. When did you meet him?
Long time ago.
Were you drinking or sober when you met him?
Oh, no, we met in a bar.
Okay.
We both come from a literary community, so I met him at a book lunch, his book lunch. I didn't know it was his book. But we certainly had a very, very fun few years. I was, you know, in my mid to late 20s, and he was, you know, quite accomplished and doing a lot of fun stuff. So, I mean, it wasn't tragic for a long time. I don't think it was ever that tragic. He's been great support. So, I feel like we've been to a war from which we came back wounded, but certainly, you know, closer than any other time. So.
I find that a great accomplishment, and it's probably due to both of you, you know, making that happen rather than anything else. Question, does your husband still drink, or is he sober?
He's a social drinker.
Does that bother you that he could drink and you cannot?
Not at all, no. No, I don't think we're all same people. So, I mean, I've never seen him drunk. I've never seen him, you know, get out of control due to his drinking. Like, there's nothing in his life that, you know, points to alcohol being, you know, a problem. And as for me being with him and him drinking, we drink. Everyone drinks. It's like, you know, there's bars, there's liquor stores. It's kind of different than things like, you know, heroin or crack cocaine. Like, you really don't need to go out of your way to run into a bottle of alcohol. I mean,
right. It's also like, it's kind of like being a food addict. There's food everywhere you go.
Yeah, exactly. You know. Yeah. There's some belief in that, you know, you shouldn't have alcohol in a house if you're an alcoholic. A lot of AAs believe in that. And certainly in the beginning, it would have been difficult. Right now, I don't even know if we have anything or not. I'm turning around to see. I have no idea. But it's not like, it's interesting because people think, oh, you know, if you have a bottle of wine, it's going to tempt you. And my answer to that is, you know, you can find alcohol in the middle of the night if there's nothing, you know, in your house. So it's not about the presence of it. It's about your control over it.
Right. I mean, that's really why my focus is on rewiring the brain, is that it doesn't matter if it's in the house or not. It's the way you think about it that changes. Mm-hmm. Are you still a very private person?
Well, I wrote a memoir, so I don't, that's a very, I love your question. I wish other people asked me that. I feel very private. It's funny, because it's, how would you feel private if I've been accused of oversharing?
No. There's something in you, and I kind of appreciate it, that you share, you're open, you're honest, but you keep a part of you very much to yourself.
Well, I think it's important, and I think a lot of writers do that. I have a friend who writes a lot of first-person writing, and she mentioned this. I don't really know enough about it. I haven't researched. She says there's a Japanese fan dance where you sort of dance with a fan and you reveal some things and you hide others. And she says that's how she writes about her personal life. And I think people confuse so-called confessional writing or first-person writing with blogging. You know, it's like, you want to give a story. You don't want to, tell people what you think every second of the day. And I don't know. I see this on social media. I see people contradict themselves within, 24 hours, saying one thing and then saying another 2 hours later. So I certainly don't want to.
Yeah, Yavita, a lot of the things that we talked about or didn't talk about in early childhood, many things that were traumatic and we just kind of blew it off, are those things still part of your memory, or have you really been able to put them so far deep within your unconscious that they don't come up?
I'm not an expert on memory. But I do believe, in my case, I think it's a continuous, line. I don't really separate myself from my childhood or teenage years. It comes up all the time, but not in a traumatic way that I can identify. But I have no problem, going there or anything like that. I certainly don't. If anything, I obsess over trivial things.
Like what?
I don't know. Cleaning the house.
Could you come over? Our office needs it.
I don't know. It's pretty. Yeah, it's nothing. I worry about my friends a lot. I think I've had a lot of, especially this summer, I had a lot of friends get really sick or. One died. It's kind of, I try to live in a present as much as I can without cutting myself off from the past. So.
Yavita, that probably, just to point out, is if you're living in the present, then don't worry. Because what worry is actually living in the what if or in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Living in the present is just,
right.
So do one or the other. But I suggest, I have an expression, fuck fear. Mm-hmm. It's just a waste of time. Did you suffer from anxiety or depression? Do you suffer from it? And was it part of your drinking?
I certainly have gone through periods of depression. Another thing I'm open about. I think that there's such thing as concurrent disorders. A lot of people think, you're depressed because you're drinking, or you have this because you're drinking. I think it's possible to have both, if you're very lucky, or both. I'm being sarcastic, but I certainly have. It's been part of my my life, depression and anxiety. I try to have pragmatic. Approach to things like that, because I think, it is a condition like kind of any other, skin condition or whatever else. It can be really debilitating if you don't treat it. So I try to deal with it as much as I can.
Okay. By the way, you're 100% right. There are multiple conditions that do happen at the same time. No one has a condition. They tend to have, you know, a number of different ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there has been at times you've had people kind of throw insults through the internet at you. I feel people who have the time to throw insults at anyone else has spent too little time looking at their own lives and investigating what it means to be a good person for themselves. But are you sensitive to when people are mean or cruel about your drinking or your motherhood?
It depends. I mean, I certainly will get defensive once in a while, but if someone's totally wrong. But also, it's kind of futile to try to convince people, otherwise. I think all feedback is important, even the crazy feedback or something that I would perceive as negative, because it's an illustration of how society thinks about, you know, things like addiction at large. And we can certainly learn from it, you know. There's like few crazy things. It's funny, like what irks me is just is just not checking facts. So there was someone, I remember reading something, someone saying that I was, you know, a spoiled, rich housewife or something, and because I sat at home and drank. And I live in Canada. We have, you know, we have mat leave. So things like that, you're just thinking, you know, you should check your facts. It's not because I'm, you know, I come from some affluent background. If anything, the opposite. But I certainly get money from the government to go on mat leave because I worked very hard, and that's part of my, you know, it's part of my
benefits.
Work package.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I don't know. I mean, it's certainly upsetting when I get personal emails. They don't happen very often anymore, but I used to get, you know, sort of threatening emails and you know, people yelling through the internet for me to sterilize myself and blah. Like, it was just, you know, it's crazy. But I agree with you that it comes from someone not examining their own life. It shows their own insecurities.
Exactly.
I find that we usually get angry at things that we have within ourselves that, you know, that irritate us in others. So
no, we get angry to divert ourselves from our own ineffectiveness and our own evil, I guess.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I certainly, you know, and to a point I sympathize too, because I think to sit down, you know, and work for 2 hours on sort of a hateful message, that can't make anyone feel good.
No, it actually does make him feel good. Because
you think it does?
Oh, absolutely, because it takes him away from himself. You know,
okay.
In the same way, it's a drug. Hatred is a drug, just like alcohol.
Yeah.
You know,
it
allows you to focus away from yourself.
Yeah, no, you're probably right. I mean, it's, then whatever, really. It's the, you know, you're a celebrity on the internet. That's awesome. I don't know. Like that. I think, you know, that's the sort of footprint you want to leave on lives. And
what are you going to tell your child about drinking? What advice are you going to give your child?
He's one person I can give advice to, because everybody else, they need to speak to professionals. I have no advice for anyone. But with him, I don't know. My advice to him would be to be open with us, because I don't know. I feel like I can't really tell him not to or to drink moderately. I mean, I feel I have some influence. But I think the biggest influence I have is in making him feel safe and comfortable to tell me about, you know, anything, whether it's alcohol or anything like trouble at school. I think that's my biggest job as a parent, to make sure that he comes to me with his problems, not you know, that he doesn't drink over them or harasses someone on the internet. I don't know. that's my hope. So.
And Yvita, I'm going to say this to you. You look like to me that you're always trying to learn and improve and evolve and discover yourself. And even though there is a definitely privacy part to you, and I think, by the way, that's necessary for everyone personally, that's mm-hmm. my belief, I think you're doing a terrific job with yourself and with your family, and it was just a total pleasure for me to have this time with you.
That's very kind of you. Thank you so much.
I want to once again thank, from the bottom of my heart, Jovita Bilowska for coming onto our show, for being so honest, for being so transparent. So you know what? Pick up a copy of her book, Drunk Mom, on Amazon.com. Okay, and check out our website on JovitaBilowska.com. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and remember, to every problem, there is a solution. There really is. Check out our other episodes, and maybe, just maybe, you have a story you want me to tell, and you want to be the one being interviewed. So let me know. Keep listening. Keep giving us your feedback. Till next time.